You could not, at the beginning of this year, have spent any amount of money to convince an AI model to score better than 50% on this benchmark. And today, on a per-task basis, you can do that for 15 cents. So literally an infinite cost decline.
Do you think a merger happens before end of year?
There's going to be 50 winners that are bigger than everything we've seen so far. And people are going to look back and be like, wow, can you believe, you know, when Apple and Nvidia were just, you know, single digit trillion companies? Welcome to The Brainstorm. Today we're talking Tesla in China. Is that a stumbling block for a potential future merger with SpaceX? And as always, AI cost declines keep falling rapidly. Brett, Elon out there saying this is not an issue. What are your thoughts? Is Tesla China a potential landmine in a SpaceX-Tesla merger?
I could understand why Tesla China poses a somewhat uncomfortable puzzle piece for any SpaceX-Tesla merger, since SpaceX has a lot of national security-related business, and there are plenty of restrictions on, you know, kind of call it dual source type technologies entering China. I don't see it as a stumbling block because there are probably ways to ring fence the Chinese assets. It is interesting that, like, Tesla Shanghai, the fact that Tesla owns its own factory there is really an anomaly relative to the rest of the automotive landscape. And I would say an underestimated testament to Elon Musk's ability to navigate kind of like political choppiness in all kinds of different ways. I think that, to be honest, for Tesla's like future value, the China factory is not that important, since robotaxi is where most of the future economics of the business are going to lie. And we don't think that China is going to be a place that they're able to generate a lot of robotaxi revenue because of combination of regulatory pressure and having to deal in local players. And it's a very low cost per mile ride hill market already. But they do export from Shanghai to non-European, non-US countries. So it is a manufacturing footprint for them that's important. But I think they'll be able to navigate around it. I don't know. What do you think? What do you think, Nick?
Yeah. Well, I was going to say, it's who doesn't want it? It's like the US doesn't want it and China doesn't want it. Can you imagine how popular their cars would be if Starlink was integrated into it? And that's certainly something that China doesn't want, but it would be extremely compelling for the Chinese consumer.
Do they have to send Starlinks around China? Or do they allow Starlinks to fly over China? No.
They can't do anything about it.
Yeah, exactly. It's in space. They fly over it. There's just
do you have to turn them off?
Or what's there's no antenna sales into China. And so you don't let service happen via that route. But as
he has a post on it, like, what are you going to do? You can just shake your fist at the sky. Like, you know, in Tehran, there's all these satellite dishes so people can get, you know, illegal satellite TV. This is prior to low Earth orbit constellations. And those were totally illegal. I think that SpaceX certainly needs to kind of like not get totally offsides of the Chinese government. So shouldn't actively try to solicit the business. But I would imagine that they would, you know, happily accept money from someone who seems to be from elsewhere who happens to have a, you know, Starlink in China. I don't know.
Isn't this largely out of like Elon and Co's hands? Like, isn't this just a government, you know, the military is, this is our stipulation if you want to merge and be a defense company, otherwise you lose all of your defense contracts type of deal? Like, as much as he's saying like, no, that's not going to happen, does he, I mean, you know, he obviously has sway in the government, but like, I'd imagine it's just, you know, military protocol to say, hey, you can't have this type of business going on with a potential adversary.
I think to Brett's point, this is not an insurmountable hurdle. It's like owning a car factory in China was arguably a bigger hurdle than figuring this out with respect to operating a business and ring fencing a portion of it. And I think I'd echo what Brett said, which is the China factory was a keystone of Tesla, I'll call 2.5, where everything was riding on the ability to scale auto and decrease battery costs. I think we are in Tesla 3.0 right now, which is the transition. And it's pretty clear Tesla 3.5 is the robotaxi, in which case, you know, that's all being manufactured in the US and the China factory still important, but no longer the driver of future value.
And it's probable that they won't be allowed to sell Optimus robots in China anyway. And I think that it's interestingly, it seems like the Chinese government might be trying to use this to block the merger. I could understand why the Chinese government doesn't want SpaceX to get access to Tesla's robotaxi tax cash flow. And so, you know, it's a complex negotiation. I'm glad I'm not in the thick of it, but I do think that Elon has shown the ability to navigate through these things in the past. And I think there are plenty of other challenges with like consummating this prospective rumored but not verified merger. This seems like a smallish wrinkle to me.
All right. Any other comments there before we move on to the, I'm sure, exciting and controversial AI cost declines and what this means for the models or application layer?
Well, wait, maybe one question. Do you think a merger happens before end of year? As in, yes. It's announced, not closed.
Well, announced,
not closed.
Yes. It won't go through, but I think it gets announced before the end of the year. I think that's quite likely. I think, well, who knows, but it could be after the major kind of IPO lockups happen. It could be after this quarter. I think there's, you know, a lot of sensitivity on kind of like whether or not SpaceX has to pay a premium for Tesla shares and what premium it would have to pay in order to win the shareholder vote to consummate the merger. And I think that if you take for a SpaceX shareholder perspective and from a Tesla shareholder perspective, they are both net better off if these entities are combined. So I think that, you know, actually at the end of the day, there has to be a working mechanism by which the entities can combine that provides fair value to both kind of sets of shareholders.
I'd agree. I think the announcement comes, as long as we're not counting the you know, the lawyer who's never been on an earnings call being on an earnings call answer a question as an announcement. But yes, I think the announcement is coming before end of year.
Yeah.
All right, Brett, you've done a lot of work here. AI cost declines. Obviously, there's lots of drama as well around what this means for the model layer and commoditization. What is important here? What should we be looking at?
Well, first, like in this past year's Big Ideas report, we showed how for a given performance on a benchmark, costs had declined 99% year over year, 100-fold cost decline. On an agentic benchmark, so actually, you would argue, actually a harder benchmark to crack, DeepSui, it's at least from basically February of this year to July 31st, on an annualized basis, costs are declining 99.99%. So basically two orders of magnitude faster than they were before. And on a prospective basis, we think they'll continue to decline a year forward by 99.97% or something, you know. So it's basically AI is getting screamingly cheap and it's getting screamingly cheaper extraordinarily quickly. Another way to think about it, it's not just that at a given level performance costs are declining, also the top end of the performance curve is increasing over time. So you could not at the beginning of this year have spent any amount of money to convince an AI model to score better than 50% on this benchmark. And today, on a per task basis, you can do that for 15 cents. So literally an infinite cost decline for that level of performance. I think those kind of like the top end rising is maybe even more important than the cost decline at a particular price, because that brings on sides more and more tasks. The cost at a particular price also brings on side tasks, but it does so probably more in the way that will flow to lower price models, where it's like, oh, I need to classify these 17,000 books for some reason, or, you know, I need to like document what each of these gene derivations does according to the scientific literature. So it'll kind of create machine, like typical ML style workloads, make them inexpensive enough that people can consider doing those kinds of research projects or sticking those into kind of products in a way that makes sense. But net, I think that the cost of whatever you're doing today with AI, whatever you're doing, if you just keep doing the same stuff, like there's a reasonable case to be made that you'll be doing it for 1/1,000th the price next year. And so I think that the what's interesting to me is, and it seems as if the performance improvement is accelerating. So, 99% to 99.99%, it means that these companies at the frontier, and there are like, you know, Grok is lined up there as well, seem to have cracked the code for recursive self-improvement of these models. And so model releases are compressing and they're getting more and more performant.
All right, Nick, the dismissive face that the YouTube commenters love.
That wasn't dismissive. That wasn't dismissive.
Okay, the models, they killed SAS, but now everyone is saying that actually the model itself is what's destroyed and the application layer is what matters. What's your take?
I mean, I agree with, you know, what you're saying. You can't really argue with, you're pointing at numbers that show a, you know, frontier. Great. I guess I'm more curious about what it actually means for the market, who ends up winning and why. To me, it's still not clear who is going to ultimately end up with, you know, the majority share of the market. Obviously, everyone's, you know, very focused on the frontier model companies because they've been able to figure out how to make coding extremely easy, which I think is where the majority of all of this spend is happening to begin with. Like, I don't think it is as ubiquitous as we believe it is from an agentic, you know, use case perspective. I think it's largely like all of this spending is happening by developers within tech companies. My, you know, thoughts go to, well, what is net? Like, where exactly does the next market opportunity open up? And is it that you need a frontier model to open that market up, or can you, you know, deliver outstanding performance with, call it open source models or a harness that is, you know, being able to optimize across both the frontier, but then once, you know, you use your frontier model for whatever use case, can you then stand up, you know, the rest of what you need to do with an open source model? And so I've been focused, and, you know, we got some really interesting data points today from Spotify, you know, the streaming music streaming platform. They're pretty open and honest. It's definitely an earnings call if you're interested in how a company that benefits from AI is using AI. This one is, I think, an interesting one because their whole, you know, shtick is, hey, we need to optimize our costs, right? Like, we went through a period of spending aggressively. Now we need to optimize our costs. We've built our own, you know, development environment, coding development environment called Honk. The next product that they built was called Chirp. Chirp is more of like a smart router behind the scenes so that when your developers are using, or anyone in the company is using a model or Honk, it optimizes to the cheapest, most effective model, both on the closed side and the open side. And to me, we've been hearing that story pop up more and more. Robinhood is doing this. Block is doing this. There's a lot of funky names out there. Goose is Block's, you know, internal development environment. And then you have Palantir, right, that announced this, you know, amazing quarter. And he's, Alex Karp, the CEO, is going after the closed model companies, saying, you know, they're actually horrible for businesses. And so to me, it's like you have, yes, the frontier, amazing progress, great. But it doesn't, to me, point to, well, they're going to be the winners in 5 years. I think they'll win a large share of the market, but I think there's still ample opportunity and room for like a lot of companies to come out and be able to play in this space.
Yeah,
I think the long-winded answer, but I'm trying to figure it out as we get all of these data, points.
I agree with the latter point there, which is, and I think this goes to our GDP forecast, which is, I don't think people understand how different the world is going to be in 5 to 7 years relative to what it is today. And I agree. I don't think we've even seen, it's like when you say winner, I don't think it's one or two winners. It's like there's going to be 50 winners that are bigger than everything we've seen so far. And people are going to look back and be like, wow, can you believe, you know, when Apple and Nvidia were just, you know, single digit trillion companies. But I think
there is a future world in which, you know, you have $100 trillion frontier model company looming out there. Like, there is a future state where that happens. It could be SpaceX, it could be OpenAI, could be both, you know. And there's another future state where it's kind of more fragmented. I think that I know that the most vocal companies are crowing about the fact that they're rolling their own and kind of like developing their own harness and going to all these other providers. I think actually the meat of the market, and I agree with you, Nick, I think actually the market is still concentrated in coding, who are the people who are most likely to do that kind of stuff. And I think the expansion point of the market is into kind of like the broader set of enterprises that don't have great engineering teams, that have like a bunch of knowledge workers. And there, I think it's actually, those are going to be customers that are much less likely to like be like, oh, I'm going to switch over to this kind of like open weight model where I don't have anybody to call if anything goes wrong. And, you know, so I think that, and the cost decline actually helps them, gives them permission to stay where they're at, even if they feel like they're overspending on AI today, because they can say, hey, you know, we have this provider that we know is best in class, and kind of our existing set of activities are going to get cheaper over time. They're delivering this efficient performance. I think OpenAI, one of the things that precipitated or actually accelerated this cost decline, even though I was doing work on it already because it was already meaningful, is that OpenAI cut prices for its Luna, which is its lightest model, by 80% relative to a month ago when they launched. Now, they did that probably in part due to competitive pressure. So I don't dismiss that as being like, oh, but they also kind of put out a blog about how they made the models more efficient. And I think they see it as like, we're going to scoop up all these enterprises into our most, you get wherever you want to be on the efficiency spectrum. And for me, having played with, you know, I'm using Luna some, I'm using Sol some, use Grok some, you know, when you use a dumber model and it makes a mistake, it is so agonizing. And so from the individual user perspective, it's like,
Sol wouldn't have done this. Pushed.
Yeah, exactly. You're like, oh, this really, you know, it's very irksome. So I think the individual users will always be trying to push for like, ah, I can't stand kind of like the mistakes that are being made here. So that's where I'm at.
I agree with you. If you look at
Grok, Gemini, OpenAI, and Anthropic, and look at their ARRs, their revenues are the second derivative is up, as in not only are they year over year growing on the order of like, I don't know, 5x year over year, but it's like accelerating. into that. And there's recently an OpenAI, at least leaked announcement on revenue that suggests they've seen an inflection as well. To hit our kind of like rough revenue forecast for frontier model companies by 2030, which is $2 trillion, they actually have to enter an aggressive growth decay from here forward, as in their top line growth has to decline 50% plus per year over the next, all the way through 2030 in order to hit that. So it's not demonstrating the characteristics of a traditional diffusion curve yet, where year over year growth declines. Actually, it's going up. And I think that's just a sign of how kind of like much market expansion we're in right now. There's multiple, you know, more people using it. The people who are using it more kind of, and it's still, we're still in discovery phase.
So it's interesting.
I do want to circle back to voice and hardware, because I think this is an element that is actually much more concentrated than saying, oh, you know, you have a harness and yada, yada, yada. It's like, I think voice has gotten infinitely better since, you know, the first versions have come out, right? There's the rumored hardware from OpenAI, whatever. But it's like, I think if you have a hardware device from one of the leading model companies, it's like, that's arguably the best way to lock in a ton of consumers into that usage. And I think we're on the cusp. And it's like, yeah, Nick, shaking the head. Why not?
I think it's a lot harder than just saying, you know, we're going to put out a piece of hardware and have this massive lock-in value. Like, I still go back to, you need to own the smartphone to have a shot in hardware, especially if you're a wearables company. And I don't think there's as much appetite from a consumer and even an enterprise perspective to capture all of the context that is valuable to these companies. Like, it's really not an engineering problem, like what you're discussing. Like, yes, conceptually sounds amazing. Socially, people will not accept everyone walking around with wires and video, like that will take
the AirPod moment.
But if people understand, like if people, there's AirPods, great. There's, you know, smart glasses, great. If people understood that they were constantly being videotaped or listened to, I think you immediately change like all of the social fabric and culture that exists in the world. And I think there will be mass resistance to that type of movement. And so like, yes, you might see, you know, one of these products get launched and they might have like, you know, an initial uptake, but I don't think they have any shot anytime soon. Like you'll need an Apple to spend like 5 years like subliminal messaging us into believing that this is somehow good for society.
Interesting. So your take is that society's just going to push back. And so it's a doomed for the next, let's say, 5 years because of social reasons, not technical.
Maybe more. Like, I don't know what flips it. Because I would love it, right? Like, it would be amazing to have, you know, a lot of your contextual life saved down somewhere. I just don't think it's possible from, you know, like, and if it is, you'll end up having like the barbell effect where like you'll have restaurants come out or like events that are like, you know, put your camera away, take your devices off. Yeah. And you'll have like a whole societal split between people that are like
bullish bathhouses.
Yeah. I think that's like a great way to play. We've been talking about this. Like there, yeah. I think there's like a whole movement on the other side of AI, which is like the one end of the extreme is what you're talking about, where like all of Silicon Valley, I'm sure, is like already wired and like listening to everything they're doing. And I think there will be a whole segment of society that's like, absolutely not, you know, we're humans. We should stay humans, yeah. Not cyborgs.
I do think it's interesting that like movies are suddenly working again, whereas video games are struggling a little bit. And I wonder if that's also kind of like the leading edge of that. It's kind of like people are like, oh, do you know what? Like digital experiences are so compressed and it feels good to be with actual humans in person. And so the sporting events and movies and the World Cup, and like, I think that, kind of the, that is a good, like counter AI play is like the, or it's, it's asserting that AI is going to accelerate probably also means that these things will both accelerate and have additional pricing power, because there's like a fixed amount of capacity of them because they're actual in-person things. So
yeah, like as soon as you can manufacture anything in the digital world, everything in the physical world on a relative basis becomes incrementally more scarce. So you'll end up as a society valuing that, whereas everything online becomes a commodity.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I mean, I agree. The movies working again, I think, is very interesting, especially it's the young generation. I don't think they even have the attention span for a 2 hour long movie.
But maybe that's what it is. It's forcing them to pay attention. And they're like, wow, this is so novel. I spend 2 hours like looking at one thing. I've never done this before. It probably feels very wholesome.
Yeah. It's like when Sora came out, I remember we talked about this. And to me, it was very obvious that, you know, just generating AI videos, people's ability to do that, like that's not actually a compelling medium on its own. Now you can slot it in, right? Like if you're an Instagram or a TikTok where you already have this huge base of human made content, well, being able to engage on like every fifth or sixth video with an AI generated video, okay, that, you know, they'll find the right balance of what that looks like. Having it as a dedicated standalone app of like, here's just an AI slot machine. It's like, what is the purpose? What are you trying to convey to me? Like, entertainment is storytelling. If, you know, storytelling becomes something that AI controls, I think humans will lose interest in it.
Yeah.
All right. We've somewhat drifted from the
very
AI
far afield
line, but I think
I'll make one last comment, which is, it is interesting that actually the first hardware device that OpenAI put out is an enterprise software developer little dongle that allows you to talk to your, you know, Codex agent and switch between tasks very quickly. And so, it does not, and in fact, it's more the norm with technologies that these are enterprise first and then the consumer comes sometime afterwards. Seems pretty clear that's how it's going to work this time as well, in part because despite the cost declines, like it's still really expensive to get all of that context and to kind of like actually process it in an efficient way. And I think that the consumer applications, for a pro user or for someone who's paying for it, they're there, but they're not there in a way that it's compelling enough for indirect monetization, given kind of like how early we are in the game.
Well, just wait a year and it's 1,000 times cheaper. So
exactly.
Done. All right. Thank you, Nick and Brett. We'll see everyone next week.
ARK Investment Management LLC is an SEC registered investment advisor. ARK, Wolf Financial, and Public are separate, unaffiliated entities and do not have a relationship with respect to any company marketing or selling the products or services of the others. ARK, Wolf Financial, and Public make no representation or warranties regarding and expressly disclaim any responsibility or liability for any acts, omissions, losses, or damages of the other entities or their affiliates, officers, employees, or agents. No company shall be liable for any indirect, incidental, consequential, or special damages arising out of or in connection with this podcast or its contents. The information provided in this show is for informational purposes only and should not be used as the basis for any investment decision and is subject to change without notice. It does not constitute either explicitly or implicitly any provision of services or products by ARK, and investors should determine for themselves whether a particular investment management service is suitable for their investment needs. All statements made regarding companies or securities are strictly beliefs and points of view held by ARK and or show guests and are not endorsements by ARK of any company or security or recommendations by ARK to buy, sell, or hold any security. Historical results are not indications of future results. Certain of the statements contained in this show may be statements of future expectations and other forward-looking statements that are based on ARK's current views and assumptions and involve known and unknown risks and uncertainties that could cause actual results, performance, or events to differ materially from those expressed or implied in such statement. ARK assumes no obligation to update any forward-looking information. ARK and its clients, as well as its related persons, may, but do not necessarily, have financial interests in securities or issuers that are discussed. Certain information was obtained from sources that ARK believes to be reliable. However, ARK does not guarantee the accuracy or completeness of any information obtained from any third party.